This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. According to the CDC, the U.S. birth rate fell by 4% in 2020, hitting another record low. People are having fewer children than the 2.1 needed to support a population that will keep replacing itself. But that's been true for years now. Researchers are still trying to figure out exactly why people don't want more children, while some are finding that even if people did want more, a rise in infertility might make getting pregnant impossible. Joining us from New York is Shauna Swan. She's a professor of environmental medicine and public health at Mount Sinai's School of Medicine. She's also the co-author of Countdown: How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. Professor Swan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jen. So happy to talk to you. Sorry to be a little hoarse. I have got a cold.
But no worries.
We can still have our conversation. Yes, I'm very happy to talk about this question with you.
Also with us from Maryland is Melissa Carney. She's an economics professor at the University of Maryland, and she's a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings researching the declining birth rate. Professor Carney, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So first, let's just get clear on some terminology, Professor Carney. Help us understand the difference between the birth rate and the fertility rate.
So when we talk about annual birth rates, we talk about how many births are occurring each year relative to 1,000 women of childbearing age in the population, right? So around, you know, now we have about 60 births per 1,000 women of childbearing age in the US. Okay, so when I talk about declining annual birth rates, that's what we're talking about. When social scientists use the term fertility rate, what we mean is an estimate of how many children the average woman will have over her lifetime. So on average, if women have 2.1 children per their lifetime, that gives us a fertility rate that meets population replacement. So our population will replace itself without immigration. When we refer in the social science economics literature to, you know, the biological ability to have children, we tend to use the word fecundity. So I'll try to be clear when I'm talking about annual birth rates versus total birth rates and refer to how many babies the average woman is expected to have.
And fecundity, define that for us.
That gets into more of the issues of people being able to realize their desired level of childbearing, right? Are they actually able to get pregnant?
Now, the birth rate has been declining in the U.S. for over a decade. What are the main reasons for that?
that's very hard to answer. So one thing I'll say is that it is driven by declining birth rates across the board. So it's not about, you know, shifts in the population towards groups that tend to have lower birth rates. We're really seeing birth rates falling for all women under the age of 30. We're seeing birth rates decline across education income groups, across racial ethnic groups. So that's the first hint that the explanation is going to be something society-wide. It's not just something that affects one group of women and not others, right? Like, we're seeing a huge reduction in births among teens, among women without high school degrees, as well as women with college degrees. So I could cut to the punchline of this, but it's you know, it takes a lot of work to explain how we get there. My colleague Phil Levine and I have been looking at this, and our bottom line read of the evidence is that it seems this reduction in births that's been happening for, like you said, over a decade, really seems to be driven by a widespread preference change. Women across the board, couples across the board, seem to desire fewer children than in the past. And it seems to reflect changing ideas about how people want to live their life, whether they view it as feasible to combine their career aspirations, their life goals with raising multiple children. And I say that in contrast to a sort of more straightforward, simple policy explanation like childcare itself has gotten more expensive, or people are burdened with student debt, or, you know, we've had tremendous take up of better contraception. Those sort of more direct targeted explanations just don't seem statistically to be able to account for any meaningful share of this large, widespread, sustained decline.
Well, we're hearing from some of you about why you've delayed having children. Tracy emailed, I'm a millennial whose career and earning potential was to an extent delayed due to the 2008 financial crisis. As a 35-year-old woman, I'm already considered late to the party when it comes to having kids. My position and earning potential are just getting to a place where I could even afford a child, but the motherhood penalty seems too big of a risk to take in the middle of my career track. By the time my career is solid, it will likely be too late to have children for me. And Pancho Vila tweeted, we are fortunate enough to be able to start our family while others want to, but can't because of how high the cost of having kids is nowadays. Right from the start, childbirth can be very expensive if people do not have insurance or the right kind of insurance. You can share your story with us. Email us at 1A@WAMU.org, tweet us at 1A, or just drop a message on our Facebook page. Professor Carney, why is this such a complicated question to research?
Well, it's complicated because it seems to be universal. And so from a research perspective, it's much easier to statistically relate things that happened in one place for a certain group of women and see that their birth rates went down by more than others. When we do that kind of thing, we can rule out a lot of explanations. So for instance, if I look at the kinds of things that people talk about in changing birth rates, things that we've studied in the past, and I say we, meaning the social science community, it's not about state mandates regarding comprehensive sex ed or Medicaid expansions in some states that happen at different times than others. It's not about, child support enforcement. If I sum up all of those things that I can very sort of cleanly statistically estimate the effects of, that can only explain about 6% of the decline in the past 13 years. And so we're left with this explanation that we're seeing this across all groups in the US, and we're also seeing this in other high-income countries. And I think that's really instructive. So the US birth rate and fertility rate has been higher than other high-income countries for a while. And now our birth rate is just sort of converging towards what we see in the UK, in the European Union. So it's not as easy as in Scandinavia, they have really generous social safety net and childcare. So if, it must be that birth rates are low in the US because we don't have those programs. Countries that do have those programs have also seen falling and low birth rates. And so it's just, in a empirical quantitative sense, it's really hard to put your finger on something that seems to be affecting women across the U.S., across states, across socioeconomic groups, and across high-income countries.
We got this tweet from Kokomo Kid, who tweets, I'm not worried. There are plenty of people on planet Earth. We're back here with Shauna Swan. She's a professor of environmental medicine and public health at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And Melissa Carney, she's an economics professor at University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings. Professor Swan, you've done a lot of research into declining fecundity in Western countries, particularly lower sperm counts. What did you find?
Well, in 2017, we published a meta-analysis in which we reported that sperm counts had declined more than 50% in the 40 years that we studied in that meta-analysis. This is one of many such studies. I think it's the biggest and I think it's the best, but it is it got a lot of press and it concerned people a lot because a drop of 50% in sperm count is huge. And even though we don't need very, very high numbers of sperm to reproduce, the mean was only 47 million sperm per milliliter in 2011, 10 years ago. And that sounds like a big number, but in fact, when we get below 40, we get to the point when we see the probability of conceiving in any cycle going down, or as we just talked about fecundity, that's decreasing fecundity, decreasing ability to have a child when you get below 40. Well, at 47, we're pretty close. We've come a long way from 99 when we began the study in 1973 to 47. And all evidence is that this is going to decline further.
Why are the sperm disappearing? And we have just about 30 seconds here.
That's a really complicated question, and especially can't do it in 30 seconds, but just let's come back and talk about that. Chemicals in the environment are definitely playing a role. Our lifestyle, stress, alcohol, obesity, etc. But my concern and what I've studied most is those chemicals in our daily lives that act like our body's hormones that our body confuses with hormones.
Well, we will get into more detail after the break. We're talking to Shauna Swan. She's a professor of environmental medicine and public health at Mount Sinai's School of Medicine. She's also co-author of Countdown, How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. Also with us, Melissa Carney. She's an economics professor at the University of Maryland, and she's the director of the Aspen Economic Strategy Group. Cecile emailed, there is no way forward for humanity if we don't reduce our numbers quickly. We have already greatly overshot the carrying capacity of the planet for people living at modern first world standards. The choice now is between downsizing or catastrophe. The reduction in births should be applauded, not feared. And a number of you are telling us climate change is a big reason why you're not having children. We'll talk about that later on in the hour. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Jen White. We're discussing the declining birth rate with Shauna Swan. She's a professor of environmental medicine and public health at Mount Sinai's School of Medicine. She's also co-author of Countdown, How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. Also with us, Melissa Carney. She's an economics professor at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings. We asked you about your reasons for not having kids. Here's some of what you had to say.
Hi, I'm Barbara. I'm calling from York, Pennsylvania. I have three adult children who have announced to me that none of them wants to have children with their partners. They think the world is just too grim. They don't really see a way out of the climate crisis, and they don't want to bring a child into the world. But their friends are having babies. It doesn't seem to sway their opinion.
This is Jessie calling from Fort Collins, Colorado. I've been married 51 years, and my husband and I never felt the need to start a family. That has enabled us to do anything or have the freedom to travel and have more money, build houses, and lead a generally very fulfilling life.
This is Hannah from Atlanta, Georgia. I decided not to have children, even though I like children, and I would if I could afford them, but I have student loans, and I grew up seeing my mom struggle and have panic attacks when she was unable to pay the bills, and how inadequate that she felt for not being able to provide for us. I don't want to live that type of life.
Barbara, Jesse, Hannah, thanks for those messages. Professor Swan, I want to pick up with our conversation talking about the chemicals that are impacting fecundity. Can you explain a bit more?
Sure. So chemicals that are man-made, that are in our daily products, such as water bottles, tin cans, cosmetics, and so on. Pretty much everything we bring into our lives has these chemicals in them. There are actually thousands of them that have the ability to affect one or more of the close to 100 hormones in the body. Our body confuses these with our natural hormones. The one I'm most concerned about are the chemicals that can lower testosterone, because testosterone is really critical to the story we're discussing today, critical for semen quality, sperm production, and for the ability to become pregnant, to desire a pregnancy, that they're related to libido.
And what we're finding is that the testosterone is declining in the world at about the same rate as sperm count is declining, and about the same rate as fertility is dropping. Now, that could be coincidence. That could be just correlation. However, we know that when a mother is exposed to chemicals that lower phthalates, and I'm going to be very specific, chemicals in, for example, making plastic water bottles soft, that may be a one of these phthalates. These make tubing soft. And why is this important? Because most of our processed food goes in tubing and picks up these phthalates. And these are in our, and so we measure these in our bodies. The CDC has measured them in everybody. And we showed in a series of studies, and animal studies showed the same thing, that when the pregnant woman is exposed to these chemicals, the males are born with genitals that are not completely masculinized. We can talk about that if you want, the details of that. But the bottom line is that animals and humans exposed to these have something called the phthalate syndrome. And part of that phthalate syndrome means that when the boys grow up to be young men, they will produce fewer sperm. Have lower fertility.
Yes? Do we know when we started to see this happening?
Oh, gosh. Well, the CDC could only measure this in about 2000. So we've had 20 years of data. But these chemicals actually are made from petroleum byproducts. So they've been produced since 1950 and have grown at an astounding rate in their number and volume since then. So they're all pervasive. And I believe that these are intimately tied to the decline in fertility.
Professor Carney, how has the fertility rate decline played out across different races and age groups?
So as I mentioned earlier, it's really been widespread. All age groups under the age of 30 are having fewer kids than in the past. Tremendous declines in teen childbearing. So teen childbearing in this country peaked in 1991. It had been considered a social challenge in the late 80s, early 90s, because of how high rates of teen childbearing were. They have been dramatically falling steadily since. So the decline in teen childbearing, and this actually is, this has occurred across racial and ethnic groups of teens. All teens are having fewer births than in the past. That decline started long before the more general decline. The only groups of women who are not having fewer, births than in the past are really women over the age of 30, but the sort of steady or slightly increasing number of births we're seeing to women over age 30 can't make up for the really large declines we're seeing to both teens and women in their younger and later 20s, which is why on net our birth rates have been declining, quite substantially now for 13 years overall. In terms of race and ethnic groups, around 2007, there were pretty large disparities in birth rates, with Hispanic women in the U.S. having much higher birth rates than non-Hispanic white and non-Hispanic Black women. Their birth rates have come down dramatically. They've experienced the largest declines in birth rates. We see that both for Native and foreign-born Hispanics. So it's not, again, just a story of like the composition of immigrants versus Native-born. It's really just widespread across the different Hispanic groups in the U.S. as well. And so now in 2020, the latest year for which we have birth data, the annual levels of births are much more similar across race and ethnic groups.
Well, we got this email from Kay who says, is there a shift to having children later in life? 30 and below seems awfully young for motherhood these days. How has the average age of a person when they have their first child, how has that changed over time, Professor Carney?
Yeah, that's an important question. So women have, the average age of first birth has gotten older. The person is exactly right who submitted that question. But what's important to realize is that delay in childbearing does translate into fewer children ever born over a woman's life. So there's some response to the stories and the government data showing a decline in birth rates that, well, just women are delaying now. It's not a reduction in fertility rates in the US. Women are just having babies later. But again, with my colleague Phil Levine, we looked at this across cohorts. And so we look at women who were born in the early 70s. So we see their completed childbearing years all the way through to cohorts born, in the 1990s. And what we see is that at every age, women in the more recent birth cohorts are having fewer children. And so even though women are having more children in their 30s than they used to, it's just not making up at all for the smaller number of children they're having in their earlier childbearing years, which is why the U.S. fertility rate, so how many children the average U.S. woman will have over her lifetime, that has fallen from comfortably above 2 to, sizably below 2. So depending on the projections, we might think that now, a woman who completes her childbearing years will have on average 1.6 to 1.8 kids. And the reason why that matters for society is that that means that our population won't replace itself without, large scale immigration. We will become an older population, a shrinking population. And the claims of environmentalists notwithstanding, that actually an aging, shrinking population puts a lot of pressure on a country or a society.
I want to get more into that in a minute. But Professor Swan, I also want you to explain the risks associated with waiting until you're older to get pregnant.
Well, first of all, fertility declines with age, most markedly in women, but also in men. But I wanted to point out another thing, which is there is a way to look at women who choose to become pregnant. And those studies of women who are not contracepting, are at risk of pregnancy, and are trying. A recent study just from Miami.
Professor Swan, we're having a little trouble with your line dropping out. We're going to try to get that line a little more secure, and we'll come back to you. We're talking to Shauna Swan. She's a professor of environmental medicine and public health at Mount Sinai's School of Medicine. Also with us, Melissa Carney. She's an economics professor at University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings. We also want to hear from you. Did you decide to have kids later in life? Why did you wait? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Jamie emailed this. I had a terrible time deciding if we wanted kids or not. We ended up having to do IVF to get pregnant. I gave birth to twin boys when I was 1 month shy of 40. They are 3 years old now. They are beautiful and amaze me every day, but also the most challenging experience I've ever faced in my life. I love my boys with all my heart, and yet there's definitely a part of me that wishes we remained child-free. The stress has been very hard on our marriage, our personal mental health, and it's extremely expensive. We also got this call from Sarah in Salt Lake City, Utah.
So my husband and I are millennials, and the decision of if or when to have kids has always been kind of difficult. We wanted to pay down student loans. We wanted to have stable housing. We wanted to live a little. In the fall of 2019, we decided that June 2020 was the magic date for us to start trying. And as you can imagine, that didn't work out. COVID hit, and I'm a healthcare provider. Instead, we got a puppy, and while she's lovely, it was still really devastating. COVID felt like this unpredictable slap in the face. Just when we were ready to start a family, the rug got pulled out from under us. I'm happy to say that I got vaccinated as soon as I could in January of 2021, and we are expecting our first child this October. Now we can start our family, and our parents can stop dropping hints that we can't wait forever to have kids.
Sarah, thanks for that message. Professor Carney, how did COVID impact child-having decisions?
Yeah, so we're just starting to see the numbers come out on this because there's a delay in reporting of official birth statistics. And in the early months of the pandemic, conceptions did drop. I mean, just as your caller indicated was her personal circumstance. This is something, again, my colleague and I, that we research these issues. We predicted at the start of the pandemic, when we started reading these stories, these cutesy stories about how people were going to be stuck at home and there was going to be a baby boom. We knew the economics evidence on this and said, no way, there is going to be a baby bust. And the real reason we expected a baby bust, and again, the early months of data really support the prediction, is because we know from previous experiences with recessions and large increases in unemployment and joblessness, those periods correspond to a reduction in people deciding to have births. Exactly as the caller said, but I mean, it's a very... There's the public health crisis, but there was also an economic crisis. And so you had this double whammy of people being worried about their health and being worried about their economic security. And so births are cyclical. We knew births were going to go down. The longer people stay out of work, the longer people remain anxious about both their economic security and their health, the more people are going to delay. And, you know, that for that's going to lead to people having fewer births over their lifetime.
And I'm considering the fact that we are still in the pandemic and there's no real clue yet when it's going to actually end. What kind of impact could this sort of protracted pandemic we're in have on this question for people?
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, the shorter the duration was, the more likely it would be that people would say, okay, I'm going to delay a few months and then I'll start my family. And so we might have seen the sort of law, you know, reduction in conceptions offset to some extent, or perhaps even fully. But the longer this drags on, the longer these births are going to be delayed, more couples are going to decide, you know, to forget the whole thing. And for the biological reasons that Professor Swan's going to tell us about, more of those couples are going to find themselves, if they delayed, unable to have children. So, you know, the longer this goes on, the more this is going to accentuate the already falling birth rate we were seeing in the U.S.
Well, and Professor Swan, you're back with us now, and you were talking about some of the difficulty with waiting until you're older to get pregnant. Please go ahead.
Yeah, so to continue with that study from University of Miami, when they looked at people who were trying to get pregnant, they looked at how long it took them, the time to pregnancy, and it turns out that the time to pregnancy, both in younger women and older women, has increased dramatically just in the past 15 years. So that's among people who want to get pregnant. So we have to separate the desire for pregnancy, which is a little bit difficult sometimes, from, women who want pregnancy to become pregnant from those who don't. And what we found is when couples go, for example, to assisted reproduction, studies have shown that chemicals in their bodies, in their urine and in their blood, interfere with their ability to successfully complete their artificial insemination or ICSI or whatever the procedure is. So there's no doubt that these chemicals can impair the ability of a couple to become pregnant. Of course, all of the factors that Professor Carney is talking about are important. I recognize that. But I think we also need to recognize that on the other side, couples are becoming increasingly unable to have the pregnancy they want when they decide they want it.
Well, and not everyone can access fertility treatments. They tend to be very expensive. What kind of an equity gap could this create if in the next few decades more and more people need fertility treatments?
That's a great question. And there are several ways in which there's an inequity here. One is that people who are from disadvantaged communities are more highly exposed to chemicals. They are more impacted by the same level of these chemicals, and they are less able to shop their way out of these being exposed. And then if they have problems, they're less able to access the assisted reproduction, as you mentioned. So it's really a huge impact that's affecting disadvantaged communities much more than those communities that are more able to deal with these chemicals.
We're discussing the declining birth rate with professors Shauna Swan and Melissa Carney. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. This is 1A. Back to our conversation in a moment, but first, we'd love your help with one of our upcoming shows about the impact of gun violence on communities. We'll focus in on the Roseland neighborhood in Chicago, but we'd love to hear from you about how gun violence has affected your community wherever you live. Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. What resources and prevention efforts around gun violence would you like to see in your area? You can send us an audio file with our app, 1A Vox Pop, and we'll share some of your stories Wednesday on 1A. Now let's get back to why people are having fewer children with Shauna Swan. She's a professor of environmental medicine and public health at Mount Sinai's School of Medicine. She's also co-author of Countdown, How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. Also with us, Melissa Carney. She's an economics professor at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings. We're also here with you.
Hi, my name is Anne, and I live in Southern California. My husband and I have decided not to have children for a few reasons. First of all is just the financial burden of it. We both have degrees, and we both love our professions, but we just wouldn't be able to support sending children to daycare, especially at an early age where it's so expensive. The second reason is due to our family system. We both have experienced family trauma, and we don't want to pass that on to future generations. And the best way we know how is just to not have children of our own. The last reason is because of the environmental impact of kids. The earth right now is crying, needing a break, and the last thing on earth it needs are more human beings. So for these reasons, and obviously many more, we've decided not to have children and be child-free and enjoy our lives together.
Anna, thanks for that message. Professor Carney, you've explained a little about why some people are worried about the declining birth rate. Can you explain a bit more?
Sure. So countries that face declining birth rates and experience below population replacement level fertility have economic and fiscal challenges. So an aging population, a population that tilts towards people who are over 65, in general, their economic dynamism lessens. So younger workers tend to be more productive on average. They're more innovative. They contribute more to technological advances. So without young workers, right, without babies being born to replenish the younger workforce, our economic growth and dynamism could be stalled. Now, we could make up for that with immigration policies that invites in a lot of young workers. We could make up for that by really increasing sort of per worker productivity. So every person needs to have a higher human capital to contribute to, economic dynamism. So it's not, I don't want to be super pessimistic. It's not like, if our population ages, we're necessarily going to be a less dynamic economy, but that threat is there. And we'd have to take measures to make sure that we maintain economic growth per capita. The other issue is young workers pay taxes, pay payroll taxes, and fund our social insurance systems like Social Security, Medicare, and disability insurance. So again, as the population ages, as we have fewer babies being born who then rise through the ranks and become young workers contributing to these systems, there are fewer workers supporting each retirement beneficiary of Social Security and Medicare benefits. And so that puts fiscal strain on the system. And so if we're going to be an aging population, then we need to address those fiscal challenges and perhaps make those kinds of programs less generous. These are real challenges. And countries have long recognized the challenge of a declining birth rate and an aging population, which is why a lot of countries have experimented over the years with explicitly pronatalist policies, things like child tax credits. Some countries have child tax credits that increase, so by your third kid, you get a larger break, to actually try and encourage people to have kids, especially those who would have kids if it were easier to afford, because this is a generally recognized, you know, as a challenge. The idea that we're going to get ourselves out of the global climate crisis by having fewer babies in the U.S., I'm not a climate expert by any means, but I just don't see support for that in the related literature, right? So my read of that evidence is that we need to reduce the human impact on the environment through reduced energy consumption per person and more sustainable production processes. We have to change the way we live, produce, and consume goods. The amount of population decline that would be necessary to meaningfully reduce the impact of human activity on the environment, you know, my sense is that that is far greater than the types of birth rate reductions we're seeing in the U.S.
Well, I want to mention that we talked about the impact of overpopulation on the planet, and you can find that conversation on our website, the1a.org. We'll also tweet out a link at 1A. I want to read this email we got from Christina, who says, "My husband and I have been trying to get pregnant for almost 2 years now. We are both 30. We both were told growing up that pregnancy would be inevitable with sex. Now we have been unable to conceive. I feel like I was lied to about how fertility works." Professor Swan, it sounds like from your research that even if everyone suddenly wanted more kids, these environmental factors could make it harder and harder to have them. How concerned are you about that? But also, has that concern reached the policy level yet?
So I am very concerned about that. And I would just want to mention, we've talked about the U.S. population. This is a worldwide problem. The fertility rate overall has dropped 50% since 1960 worldwide, and every country is dropping. And in fact, the countries that were having a very high rate initially are dropping faster. So this is going on everywhere. And so, you know, I don't know how much this is going to be solved by immigration eventually. In China, in Japan, in Singapore, in Malaysia, they have rates that are close to 1 instead of 2.1, 1.0, 1.2, 1.3. I've seen even 0.85. I'm not sure I believe that. But it's really getting alarming. And those countries with very low fertility rates are not able to turn this around. Those economic incentives that governments are offering to people are not changing this dramatically. So this is because the economics is just one part of the story. The other part is the fecundability, the ability to have children, has decreased. I think this is extremely alarming. And by the way, I think couples that want to have a child should have the right to have a child. They should not have that taken away by our being, if you will, invaded by these chemicals about which we have no information, no knowledge when they come into our bodies. And that's what's happening.
We got this question from Insys Comics, who says, if the chemicals in questions have been in our food, though, as you've said, they're present in other places as well, since the 50s, why is the birth rate only dropping now? Professor Swan?
That's a great question. First of all, the levels have increased. The numbers of chemicals have increased. But there's also a very complicated story having to do with the impact of one generation's exposure on successive generations. So what we have shown in animal studies and in human studies is that when you successively expose generations, you get a cumulative effect. And Pat Hunt at the University of Washington showed this beautifully in a rodent study. And that's what's happening. The fetus inside the woman has the germ cells that are going to give rise to the next generation, and we see there three generations affected. There are also people think that effects can go on through epigenetic changes even further. So I think what we're seeing is it started back, we don't know exactly when there was a critical mass of exposures, but certainly after 1950, and then there's been a successive drop ever sense.
Professor Swan, how can people avoid these chemicals? If they're present in so many of the things we use every day, can we avoid them?
Not entirely. I think actually it's not really our job to worry about them, but we have to because they're not regulated. These chemicals are not regulated. Very few of them are regulated. I'll give you an example. In the EU, there are 1,100 chemicals allowed in personal care products. I'm sorry, 11,000 banned from personal care products. In the U.S., there are only 11. So in the U.S., we're not protected nearly as well as we should be. In the EU, they are not protected to the extent they should be. So people can try to avoid the use of plastics in their kitchens, particularly. Try not to, definitely don't microwave in anything plastic, don't store, and try to buy food in as simple a form as possible. Unprocessed food is ideal. Don't buy canned food because there's a chemical bisphenol A in those cans. And try to eat organic whenever possible because pesticides are also chemicals that can affect the body's hormones.
We're talking to Shauna Swan. She's a professor of environmental medicine and public health at Mount Sinai's School of Medicine. And Melissa Carney. She's an economics professor at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings. Lorraine emailed, I'm 74 years old. My son and his wife are childless by choice, and my daughter and her husband have two teenage boys. As much as I love my grandsons, I secretly hope they never have children. I worry about the world they will live in, and I don't want to even think about what my great-grandchildren would face. I think things have just gone too far. And Amber emailed, I'm 35 years old and my fiance is 30 and we've decided not to have children. And most of my friends have decided not to as well. I was in the military for 8 years and deployed to Iraq in 2006. I went to grad school after the military and have had jobs in the nonprofit world. My fiance is a journalist. We have a lot of freedom to have careers in our passion, though these careers do not necessarily pay well. With climate change, political, environmental stress, we haven't really found reasons to have children. We barely have time for our passion outside of work, like music, art, and hiking. Professor Carney, do you think the birth rate will rebound?
I don't see any reason to think it will. I mean, you know, people who say it's going to rebound because people are just delaying, we're not seeing that. Women are having lower births at all ages. I think it's really important to emphasize that the economic social factors that I'm talking about that seem to be driving people to choose fewer kids, those are amplified by the types of challenges that Professor Swan is talking about. So if you have fewer people choosing to have children, and then people who are intent on delaying until they feel like their life is in better shape and then find themselves unable to have children, or people who throughout their childbearing ages are now finding it harder, all of that points in the direction of real population decline. And I don't see any indication on any of these fronts to think it's going to turn around. And Professor Swan alluded to it. The types of things that governments can do, like make childcare more affordable, you know, make parental leave more readily available, those are tinkering around on the margins. And I applaud those efforts for, we've heard from some of your callers who just would like to have children, but find it too expensive for people who are on the fence. Those are great things, and they might tip the scales, but they're not going to dramatically turn this around.
Well, just a few decades ago, people were worried that we were having too many children, and we're hearing from a lot of people who still are.
My name is Maggie. I'm from Montevideo, Minnesota, and I'm just calling to let you guys know that I do not plan on having children, and the last 4 to 10 years have decided that for me. Until the world leaders, and especially, well, and the leaders of this country decide that they want to do something substantial about climate change, I can't subject somebody that I'm going to love so much to the low quality of life that people are going to have going forward. And it's just too painful to watch. I would love to have kids, so hopefully these leaders take action and do something about climate change so that I can have children. The pandemic didn't help, but at the end of the day, it's the way the climate is changing more than anything.
Well, and I just want to note that a lot of our audience is citing climate change as a reason to not have children. Now, Professor Carney, I know you said that decreasing the population will not have the kind of impact on climate change from your read of things that people hope. But from a policy perspective, whether it's about climate change or other issues associated with declining birth rates, what would you like to see happen?
I mean, it is, you know, on a personal level, I'd like to see people who want to have children able to have them. And so, you know, the first thing here, I think, is the types of, you know, biological changes that Professor Swan is talking about are really quite tragic. I also think that the way we think about declining birth rates from a normative perspective really depends on what we think the causes are. I'm a little struck by how many of your callers are just like, I've decided to do other things with my life. I've decided to pursue a career. We could spend money on vacations, et cetera. I hope those people find themselves happy in 30 years from now. To the extent that people feel like they can't afford kids or have to delay kids and then can't get pregnant, there's an amount of personal loss there, you know, that I think most of us would find sad if someone can't have the children they'd like to have. But, you know, to the extent it's people think it's too hard to combine with career and work and having kids, then I'd like us to have a society that's more conducive to people raising children. But either way, there's an economic challenge here. If we're going to be an aging population, that presents economic challenges to the country.
Well, and Professor Swan, in just about 45 seconds here, what would you like to see done about the environmental factors affecting fecundity?
I'd like to see governments take the lead in limiting exposure to chemicals that can affect our body's hormones. And these measures have to be taken quickly. I'd like to see the chemical industry develop alternatives that do not have hormonally active components so that we stop poisoning our bodies with these chemicals that alter our very basic hormones that drive our fertility and our reproductive health.
That's Shauna Swan. She's a professor of environmental medicine and public health at Mount Sinai's School of Medicine. She's also co-author of Countdown, How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. Also with us today, Melissa Carney. She's an economics professor at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings. Thanks to you both. Today's producer was Amanda Williams. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.